Pushkin. Hi, I'm Phil Donahue.
And I'm Marlo Thomas. And we're going on a series of double dates to find out
what makes a marriage last. It's not every day that I get to hang out with a former pro quarterback. So I was pretty excited when we met up with Rodney and Holly Robinson Pete.
I knew you'd be happy to talk to a real NFL champ. And Holly has had success in so many TV shows. They're a classic power couple. All I had to do was set the levels on the recorder, and it was game time.
Okay, so Rodney, will you go first? Well, you're on the radio. You have a pretty good voice.
I got to turn into my radio voice right now.
Wow.
Yeah, Rodney P. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
You got a good
and for
one.
Holly, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Oh, yes.
We're not going to have any. Oh, well, she's the French
major.
Yes, she is. Yeah, that's how I got him.
That's how she hooked me. It's the French.
That's great. Yes. You got a great voice.
We started off talking about their wedding, which Holly told us was a fantastic affair.
And the ceremony was presided over by my old pal from my Chicago days. None other than the Reverend Jesse Jackson.
Yes, he was like a kind of a godfather, an uncle, if you will.
And so he took you out for a ride before?
He took us for a ride, and he essentially just started counseling us. We thought we were going to get this really awesome counseling moment. And he said, are y'all like is ready for this? Because this is no joke. This married thing. Jackie and I have been married for decades, and you got to really be ready. And we said, we think we're ready.
How old were you?
I was 29 at the time.
And I was 31.
Yeah.
So you were not babies. That's good.
No. We and thank God we weren't, because that helped.
Yeah.
Because had we, I think, met and started dating in early 20s. We wouldn't be here today. As Holly likes to say, I was a...
You were throwing a lot of passes.
I was monogamously challenged, is what she would say.
Monogamously challenged.
Yes. She was dating someone, and I was dating everyone, is what she put it.
Well, I mean, come on. An NFL quarterback?
You got to experience the whole thing, right?
Holy cow. I mean, how many millions of young men go to bed every night saying, oh, I wish
I was a quarterback. Yeah, in the NFL. So, I had to find out what that was like. Yeah.
So how did you...
Your favorite girl wasn't so impressed.
How did you tame him?
I was very unimpressed with the whole idea of dating a quarterback. When he was drafted and when he was a big star at USC, he was sort of off my radar. There were only a handful of black quarterbacks then in this time period. And so he was kind of on my radar because I remember my dad saying, oh, this guy had a... Dad was a big football fan, mainly Eagles, but big football fan and certainly a proponent of black quarterbacks. So whenever there was one that was making waves and Rodney was on the cover of Sports Illustrated when he was at USC, he was like, you know about this guy, Rodney Pete? And I was like, meh.
Right.
I was dating someone at the time, but he was really, this guy wasn't the smartest, he wasn't the sharpest tool in the shed. I think of myself as a worldly person. I went to Sarah Lawrence and I had a junior year in Paris, and he was definitely not on my level. When I wanted him to go to Vietnam with me, he asked, wasn't there still a war going on in Vietnam?
Oh, great.
Yeah, this is what I'm talking about. So, but the idea of dating a quarterback...
Was what? The last thing?
You Why?
On paper, it sounds very sexy.
Well, how did you meet?
We met it was an R&B kind of dinner club kind of thing. And so we were, happened to be sitting, and it was one of those community tables. So I was with my friend and she was, who were you with?
Leela.
And so we sat together and listened to music. And I instantly, because I knew who she was, but instantly was even more attracted to her when I got to talk to her and know her. And then she began to eat. She ordered a big plate of French fries and doused it with ketchup and then put hot sauce on top of that. And I was like, okay, this is a girl likes to let her hair down. And,
So here was this nice setup, the perfect get to know you, but Holly wasn't exactly feeling the vibe.
At least Rodney did. And fortunately for him, the two of them had a mutual friend.
And she said, I really like this guy for you. I hate this guy you're dating. And I really need you to stop sitting around waiting for him to page you. Get up, put on your Daisy Dukes. We're going to Rodney Peet's house for a pool party. And I was like, who? She said, that guy you saw at the R&B club. You need to go. Let's go see him. I was like, whatever. Turns out he was only literally a 5-minute drive from my house. I said, well, that's interesting. So we go to the party, nothing but girls lined up against the wall. And a lot, and very few guys. So I was like, okay, where's there something to eat? Again, me eating. So we grabbed a brisket off the barbecue, we ate it, and then we left. And about a half an hour later, there was a knock on my door. I remember he only lived 5 years, and it was Rodney. I opened the door, and there was Rodney with all these teeth just smiling at me. And he was like, I said, don't you have a party going on at your house? He said, well, when you left, the party was over.
Oh. And what a like, good opening line, Rod. Did you
write
that?
That's going to get you one
day. You wrote that on the way, right?
So I was like, okay. So that's when I really decided to give him a shot. And we really, with the exception of maybe 2 or 3 awkward moments, have not ever been apart since. And that was 26 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah. So we, you know, we had a couple ups and downs and moments. We've never really broken up and... But the litmus test was, will he travel with me? When I asked Rodney to go to Indonesia and Southeast Asia with me, and he said yes, I thought, okay, this might be something.
I did want to go and travel, like really travel, but I'm a big geography and history guy. And so I always wanted to travel, but I never could really find people that wanted to be that kind of adventurous. It was... Hey man, let's go to Japan. When I got done with football, like let's go to Japan or let's go to Italy or let's go somewhere else, South America. And the group of friends that I had, close group, said, no, let's just go back to Hawaii and play some golf, or let's go to Mexico
or Cancun
or something like that. It was never
Spring
really
break stuff.
Really like really exotic type of traveling.
Right.
Even though I wanted to, it just always gave in to the people I was with or around, and it was just an easy thing to do.
Right. You know? But that time when you said he was monogamously challenged,
yeah.
How did you get past that?
I had to literally, like, remember that song, The Cleanup Woman?
Yeah.
I had to be the cleanup woman. I had to go in, and the thing was he was allowing me. So when girls would call or try to come over, I had to say, he is now officially unavailable. Like, no more Rodney. I'm that Rodney Peet, that Mr. Gregarious, the guy that giving all the parties, he's dead.
And did you buy into that, Rodney?
Her cleaning up?
Yeah.
It was, yeah, I did, because I really liked her. But it was uncomfortable at times, I would say, because I think I had a certain way of living, and I was comfortable living that way, not realizing that I really needed to change, because my place and my world was, I had a lot of male friends would like to go hang out. My place was the meeting place. It was like everyone would come to my house before we go to dinner or go out, and then we would end up back at my house afterwards, and so I was like central.
It was always Rodney's house.
Yeah. So
Rodney's
always
house
my
was
house.
The central point.
Yeah.
Your folks were like that in Beverly Hills.
Yeah, yeah.
For the comics.
Yeah.
The party was always happening there.
Right.
The cool house.
Yeah.
And I had to kind of like say to him, now, you got to make up your mind what you want here, because it's not going to be this gray area for me. I was working, a self-sustaining, you know, woman, and if he wanted me and not your typical NFL wife, and by that I mean someone who basically picks up and goes to the NFL city and takes care of their man all day long, I wasn't going to be that person. And I couldn't run around and try to just police him all the time. So the little parties had to stop. Like these parties had to go.
I never really broke things off with girls I dated or girlfriends.
Yeah, he always left the door just a little bit ajar.
Yeah.
Just a little bit of space. And that gray area wasn't working.
Yeah, the gray area was definitely not working.
Bless you.
Deep down inside, that's what I wanted. I did not want that, the woman that I would eventually marry, to have an identity that was attached to mine. I wanted her to have her own world and have her own things and have her own career and not be that one that's waiting for me to come home going, okay, you're home now, yeah, what do we do now, and kind of thing. I didn't really want that. So that was another thing that excited me about Holly, that she could, I guess, pick up and leave at any time and be good with it.
Right.
And didn't need me.
And when did you know he was the one?
I think I knew he was the one when he didn't put up a fight when I was kicking all those girls out of his life. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was going through drawers, was checking phone records.
Really?
Yeah. My parents had a terrible divorce. I had this vision of being married for my whole life. And I just wanted to make sure he was telling me the truth and being honest with me.
How old were you when your parents got a divorce?
Like around 6, 7.
Oh.
Yeah.
And what about your parents' marriage?
54 years.
Really?
Yeah, still going.
Ah, wow.
Yeah.
So that's what I wanted.
Yeah. Right.
And I love that he had this marriage, this mom and dad that, you know, together forever.
So you knew...
So I knew when I saw him not resisting me, he was allowing me to do my thing.
Right.
I think he understood early what I needed to feel comfortable, and he allowed me to do it.
Right.
And when I saw that he wouldn't, you know, he didn't shut me down, I thought, wow, he must be pretty serious about this.
But that was the male behavior you were accustomed to witnessing?
I was accustomed to witnessing guys try to push back on me. You know, trying to get them to be monogamous.
Threatened by you.
They were very intimidated and threatened by me because I'm a strong woman who does my own thing. And not many of you guys who are, you know, not many of you, the Phils and the Rodneys of the world, are comfortable with strong women who are independent. To some people, that's a threat, not an exciting thing. For Rodney, that was a plus.
But you're perfect for a quarterback. I mean, really. You know, you cannot be a shy little bird married to an NFL quarterback. I don't think that works.
But a lot of guys want that. They do want that.
They don't want the shy bird, do they?
A lot of them do. They want, you know, this is my time.
But to Phil's point, when you are the quarterback's wife, you got to kind of be a first lady. You have to organize things. You got to speak for the, you know, you have to take care of the receivers' wives, the offensive line wives.
Oh, really?
You got to be Switzerland with everyone.
You got to really be on your game.
No kidding.
So it's not just stand there and look pretty. The life of a quarterback's wife is not easy, especially in Philadelphia. You have to have a thick skin. And he did choose the right person. So we would, you know, we would do a lot together. We were a good team.
There was one time that she kind of
what
got involved in a little dispute when they were bad mouthing me a little bit.
Oh, what did you
Philadelphia.
Do? Who was bad mouthing you?
Well, the media. We had a bad game, and everybody was coming down on me, and they were blasting me. And so this one decides to call in to the radio station.
Good for you.
But disguise her voice.
Oh.
Like, tell these guys, you don't know what you're talking about. And she was being way too specific because she was defending me so hard that these guys...
And they kinda, totally made me.
Yeah, they did.
Those were some tough, tough, tough days, yeah.
We'll have more after a quick break. We're back to our conversation with Rodney Peet and Holly Robinson Peet. And Marlo wanted to know about their biggest challenge as a couple.
The big giant challenge came when RJ got diagnosed with autism.
Yeah.
So when he was 3 and he got diagnosed, that was the kick in the gut.
Mm-hmm.
Like that, to this day, I'm not sure how we survived that. Because there was blame and denial and... You know, when I found out, when we got the diagnosis, you know, I went to books and I started dog-earing pages and highlighting passages, just trying to turnkey it for him. And then I would go, by then he was playing for the Raiders, and I would go to Oakland, and I'll look under the bed, and there was the whole package that I sent with all the highlighted passages, not even opened. He didn't even look at it.
Because?
He's in denial.
Yeah.
He didn't want to deal with the fact. We didn't know what autism was. This lady sat down across from us. This developmental pediatrician told us everything our son would never be. He won't speak. He won't go to mainstream school. He won't play sports. It made Rodney crazy. It made him feel, you know, she told us what this three-year-old would never be.
Wow.
And it was just the most
horrible,
awful, horrible thing. And then you start blaming each other. You're like, we don't know why he got this thing. We don't know what autism is. He has a twin sister, you know, and he wasn't hitting the milestones that she was hitting at the same time. And
there were no signs of anything with her.
No, but crazy, when they went in for the diagnosis, for the evaluation, she mimicked him the whole time. She was like, you're going down, I'm going down.
Oh.
And they came back to us with diagnosis, they're both on the spectrum. We're like, what, her too? No way. And then, oh yes, yes, she's doing everything. She's flapping and stimming and turning and twirling and not making eye contact. And then when she came out, and this is a three-year-old, right? And we didn't realize it till later that she was mimicking him to let him know that she was with him.
Oh.
She's not on the spectrum. She's, you know, a normal, typical kid, but
boy,
she.
Boy, talk about battering for you, Glenn.
Oh yeah, it was rough.
It was and rough. So, mind you, when you go in and she spends 40 minutes with your kids and says, she gives you a lifelong diagnosis, you're like,
well,
really?
It was longer than 40. The it's like a two-hour thing.
Yeah.
It
so
might have felt like 40 still 2 minutes. Hours. Like, it's still
in that short a period of time. You're gonna tell me what my son will never do?
Right.
So that was the beginning of when I didn't know. Like, I always envisioned, oh, I'm gonna have this husband forever, and that was the first moment where I was like, he's not getting on board with what I need to do. I have to roll up my sleeves and become a gangster for this kid.
And she did. She did.
I cannot worry about, oh, he's not the son I dreamed of, and he's not going to play in the NFL. He's not going to win the Heisman Trophy. Like, the little things that I felt like Rodney was, like, obsessing on, although they weren't really those things. But to my mind, they were. Whenever RJ would come to the games when he would play, all the other football players' kids would run around and get autographs and be, like, you know, into it and connecting, and RJ would be twirling around in the corner, flapping his hands, you know, not talking to anybody. And it was devastating. If I had to go back, I would have been nicer and more patient, because I understand now that the processing of the diagnosis of autism, especially for a dad and his son, is much different than it is for a mom.
I think that affected me than more so than it affected her.
We were dealing with bullying at school. There was so much going on. And now when you look back, I realize that as much as we blamed each other or were frustrated with each other because I was frustrated that Rodney was in denial. And I knew that denial was eating up time. And there was a small window of time that RJ had to get his brain right in order to present himself to the world. And Rodney was not moving fast enough for me. And it was the only time, even with all the football teams and the drama that we dealt with or whatever we were dealing with, that I felt like, I can't do this with him because he's slowing me down. He's holding me back from just doing everything I can to get this kid ready for life.
Because I was stuck in my own selfish world, like, why me, and what did I do wrong, and this is not the vision I had for my firstborn son, and I want him to experience the things that I did growing up because it was beneficial for me, and now he's going to do it. And then I went into, okay, I'm an athlete, I'm going to do it like my dad did, I'm going to coach it out of him. And I was not equipped with the right tools. I didn't believe the therapies. I just said, I can do this myself. And it came to a point where she's like, you got to get on board. And there was an embarrassing moment with all of the therapies and one of our big group sessions that I was asked to kind of do some things, because it doesn't end at the therapy. You got to go home, and it's 24/7. You got to you know, talk to him the right way and engage with him the right way. And I didn't have any of those tools because I didn't study. I didn't, wasn't willing to learn. And so the embarrassing moment was when the therapist asked me to engage with my son, and he had no engagement with me. No eye contact, no laughter, no playing. And then one of the other therapists got on the floor with him and started talking to him in special ways, engaging him with eye contact certain ways. And he immediately lit up and responded to everything that she was doing. And it wasn't like immediately the light went off, but I did deep down know that I was doing, so I had to change the way I was thinking. But I responded like, she set me up to this, set me up to fail. She was, mm-hmm. you know, trying to make me look bad. Mm-hmm. And this, so I was still stuck in my selfish ways. Mm-hmm. And she was like, look, this is the way it has to happen. And unless you can do this and get on board with it, we can't last.
And so when he realized that he, you know, had to change his ways and it happened on a dime, it was just the most amazing thing. So thank God.
Right.
Right? And that was huge hurdle, huge Pete hurdle number one.
Yeah.
That was one I didn't think we were gonna. So that's, when that happened, I was like, oh shit, we can handle a lot of other things now. Like, cause that one was tough.
Right.
It breaks up couples very, very easily. Hmm. So that was a huge hurdle, and I'm glad he came through.
And how lucky is he to have enlightened parents like you guys? I mean, I know.
Oh, he is.
Really, I mean,
he's very lucky,
and also, I mean, I suppose that what that doctor said, that pediatrician said that day, was not true.
Oh, that poor doctor! I went on Oprah show and talked about that doctor so bad. I feel badly. I didn't mention her name, but I wanted other parents to hear. If you're getting this diagnosis today, never let some doctor tell you what your 3-year-old is going to become.
Right.
It's a horrible thing to do and there's so much hope that she robbed us of in that moment. And had I not been the bulldog mom and the Johnny come lately dad who was on board later on, we might have succumbed to that hopelessness.
So this is this gigantic boulder in the middle of your marriage.
Yes.
How do you still become a couple who gets to play?
I think there was a period of time where it was just so about RJ that we did neglect each other. We tried to make it about each other, but I think it just became get this kid as right as possible so that when we die, he's going to be okay.
And how did you find your way back to each other?
We've done a lot of talking, a lot of advocacy. I think the advocacy and starting the foundation and meeting with other parents and seeing the change we were affecting helped us go, okay,
we're doing something right.
And that bonded us. It's powerful when he goes and speaks to other dads, because especially
about his
being a macho black athlete, and like they sit in the room, go, wow, he was in denial. And they're like, see, honey, he's in denial.
Right,
and he figured it out.
Right.
And so that's a powerful, some powerful image to put out there.
Right.
So
tell us about RJ today.
Oh.
Start crying. The waterworks.
Wait, yeah, you go, Phil. You still doing them waterworks things, huh?
Well, boy, it wasn't intentional.
Well, he now works for the Los Angeles Dodgers. He's a clubhouse attendant. They love him. Oh. And every time I put on social media or a post, I say, thank you, Dodgers, for giving my son a job. They always write me back going, no, thank you for RJ. You know what he brings to this clubhouse? Mm. We've had some tough losses over the last few years. RJ is the guy that has to put the champagne back in the sixth inning. You know, when we're going to lose the World Series or whatever. So it's an emotional thing, an emotional journey. So when the doctor told us he would never have a job and he would probably never have friends, he never had friends growing up. And now he has, you know, a whole dugout full of friends. And that's really just so powerful. So RJ is driving. RJ is, he's communicating, he's connecting. He has a great job, his dream job.
Makes his own money, does his own banking. I mean, he is, and he's happy. Like I said, he's driving and he's connecting with people.
Still has issues. Yeah. Still has a lot of OCD. Can't talk to women or girls yet. And I'm not just saying this because he's my baby, but he's gorgeous. And so it's a success story.
Yes.
The kid that was the one we were worried about, that was kind of pushing us apart.
Yeah. Brought us back together.
Brought us back together and still does.
Did you go to couples therapy?
Yes.
Yeah.
From day one. By the way, I should say, that was the one of traveling to far places was one criteria. And the other was you have to be willing to sit down with a shrink. And Rodney Pete did not come from that. That's not in his background. Like his parents were like, where are you? Are you giving my son a lobotomy? Yeah. And so he had to be willing to do that. And when he said yes to that, because these little strong black men don't do that. They do not sit down in a room and have some person tell them anything. That's just, they'll go to a pastor or a preacher.
We went a couple times. The Irishman here didn't sit well with him. We had a fight in front of the therapist the first day, and he left, slammed the door. Before we were married, and the therapist was my therapist. And the therapist said to me, this is not the guy for you.
That sounds like the Never Day Lady.
I know. because I mean, in the middle of a meeting, he gets mad and leaves.
That's not a good sign.
Not a good sign at all. This guy's not good for you. But it was interesting because every time we would run into that therapist years later, he would say, you guys kill me. You don't resolve anything, do you? We don't resolve everything. You can't resolve everything.
But so, I like that. I mean, you can't resolve everything. Yeah. And I do, I think if I have one of my very few faults that I have, that I do try to micromanage, our relationship sometimes. The autism thing was rough, but you mentioned the other hurdle number two or three, I lost count, retirement, when he retired.
Yeah.
When the lights went out on the football career, I thought I was ready for it. But I think I was so worn out from the autism stuff that I was like, is this now what?
First of all, you don't want it to end because it's something you've done for 8 years old. And then on top of that, it ends at 38, and everybody's just in the prime of their working career at that time, And
although so 38 is old for
old for my profession. Yes, exactly. Yeah. So now you're at 38 years old, and you're like, okay, I just had a wonderful life doing what I always wanted to do. That's over. Where am I going to find that high? Where am I going to find that same feeling?
Rush.
Yeah. Where am I going to get that rush from? And I went right from playing to a show, being hired by Fox to do a pretty popular show called Best Damn Sports Show. But I wasn't happy. I mean, I was like still thinking that was going to fill that void. So I spent a lot of time chasing that rush because there was no handbook. There was no handbook to say this is what you're supposed to do or feel like or all those type of things.
And then the other thing that was happening was Rodney was in immense pain from playing football. They had opioids hanging out in the, like mints in the locker rooms. And so he was dealing with...
To get them through the game, you mean?
Get them through the game, get them through life, get them through the week, and he was drinking. And so he was dealing with all of those things on top of retiring and then me in denial about what those things were causing. And he didn't know how many concussions he had. He had so many.
As an athlete, you just basically live within pain. Because in football especially, you play on a Sunday, you don't feel good until that following Friday or Saturday because you're dealing with the pain from the past Sunday. Opioids and things that they gave you that we find out now that was just so terrible and detriment to your body, they give it out like candy. Yeah, there were definitely dark moments and dark times and...
Drinking
and taking pills. Found myself constantly, like when you dream and you're in a place, you fall and you can't stop falling. You're always falling.
Right,
you can't find anywhere to get safe. It was that kind of feeling in terms of chasing that rush.
Because we mean but retirement is a huge thing.
Yes.
Everybody in the world is going to have to retire.
At some point. Well, and I think the biggest thing and the biggest part of it is, and it's 100% true, is that I would not be here being able to overcome a lot of the things that I've been able to work through and overcome if she was not willing to work it out with me.
You've been through so many big tsunamis,
yeah.
You know, and you've ridden the wave and hung on to each other through it. I mean, what if that isn't love? What is? I mean,
and
you
still,
got it,
and still doing it too, yeah. Marlo. Like still there, like still still some of the repercussions of some of the decisions that were made.
Right.
Still paying for that a little bit. Still dealing with that. And
still a work in progress.
It's yeah. still a work in progress.
Everybody's a work in progress.
Right. Right till the end.
One couple we said, they said, we're always under construction. I mean, you are. We are too. Don't think we've made it. I mean, we're still riding the waves of all kinds of stuff that we have to.
And you're never not a parent.
You guys have been amazing. I mean, this
really
is
fabulous.
It's really so juicy. So
it had.
And as we were wrapping up, Holly and Rodney had some terrific advice for all couples who are works in progress.
We do something called, we call it same page love, where if you're on the same page, things are good. When you're on a different chapter or even a whole nother book, that's a bad thing.
So when you say we try to get same page love, is that like an exercise?
Yes, that's sit down, allow each other to talk and listen. Like give them a time limit. Maybe it's 15 minutes, okay? Now you're on the clock. Because what happens is...
Then you come to an agreement.
Are you the couple that also has the 20-second hug?
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
I read that somewhere.
Oh, my gosh.
Well,
such
and
a good
when
research.
Someone, if I call for it, she's got to give it to me, and vice versa.
Can't pull away. You got to hold that hug. There's all this energy going on. You want to just fucking kill them.
Because what happens, you, even though you're angry, you start reminiscing about why you're together and what it means to be together.
I think it's pheromonal.
That physical thing.
I think it's a physical, your heart connects to each other.
Yes, I mean, all that comes out, right? It's just the connection.
That's Rodney and Holly Robinson Peake. What an inspiring couple.
It just goes to show that with bravery and perseverance, you can get through almost anything as a couple.
As long as you have the right person on your team. Until next time, I'm Phil Donahue.
And I'm Marlo Thomas.
Well, you gave us two great pieces of advice, the 20-second hug and the get on the same page.
Same page love.
Same page
That's
love.
Great.
That's our little hashtag.
That's great.
Gotta have a hashtag these days, Marlo. If you don't got a hashtag, you ain't doing nothing.
We're too old for that.
Double Date is a production of Pushkin Industries.
The show was created by us and produced by Sarah Lilly. Michael Bahari is associate producer. Musical adaptations of It Had to Be You by Stellwagen Symphonette.
Marlo and I are executive producers, along with Mia Lobel and Lital Molad from Pushkin.
Special thanks to Jacob Weisberg, Malcolm Gladwell, Heather Fain, John Schnars, Carly Migliori, Eric Sandler, Emily Rostek, Jason Gambrell, Paul Williams, and Bruce Kluger.
If you like our show, please remember to share, rate, and review. Thanks for listening.